My goodness, Thanksgiving's here already. I'm hoping that all you constant listeners get some deserved rest and relaxation. I am a big believer in Thanksgiving dinner, a top marquee event of the year for me. I've loved that holiday since I was a little kid, and I give it all I have every year. This is your fully committed to Thanksgiving host, Nick Deolius, and you are entering the Far Middles episode number 79. We're dedicating episode 79 to the 1979 Pittsburgh Pirates, World Series champions, uniforms so awfully arranged that they look beautiful, if that makes any sense to you, and a team that became associated with a song from Sister Sledge, We Are Family. Now, the 1979 Buccos, they were in my sweet spot of sports as a kid. I was around 10 or 12 years old, and the Pirates and Steelers were hugely competitive in winning championships left and right. In fact, it was in the late 70s, and when the Pirates won it all in 79, that Pittsburgh became known as the first city of champions. Hey, sports back then in Western Pennsylvania, it was a soothing balm for tough times. You had industry that was collapsing, people were losing jobs, families were being uprooted out of the region. You know, things, they were bleak, but sports, including those 79 Pirates, they provided a needed distraction, to the point where it became a point of pride for the city and for the region. Sports in its heyday here in the 70s got us all through the most challenging of times. Today in Western Pennsylvania, you know, things have inverted a bit. The positive is that the region's doing better because industry, like energy and manufacturing, they're doing a bit better. But the bad news, you know, the Pirates are at rock bottom. In fact, the last playoff series won by the Pirates was the 1979 World Series against the Baltimore Orioles. Think about that. That's over 40 years ago. Not a championship drought, but a winning playoff series drought. Now, the 79 Pirates, they were Willie Stargell's team, just as the 71 World Champion Pirates, they were Roberto Clemente's team. Stargell was the captain. He was a great motivator. He would pass out Stargell stars to teammates who did something exemplary in a game, and then the players would affix the stars to their hats, sort of like what you see with some college programs and what they do with stickers on helmets in college football. Now, Willie Stargell, he led by doing. He had a great year in 79. He won the National League MVP, shared that award with Keith Hernandez, and he also won the World Series MVP. He was the oldest ever at the time to win either award at 39 years of age. And in the World Series, he hit 400 and tied Reggie Jackson, Mr. October's total bases record for a single series. Not too shabby for a 39-year-old. But the Pirates had some other great players on that 79 team. Dave Parker, for sure, who we dedicated episode 39 to. Bill Madlock, he was a clutch hitter, four-time batting champ, for goodness sake. I mean, players can say that. Mike Easler was one of those unsung heroes. And with pitching, you had the Candyman, John Candelaria, Burt Blyleven, he's in the Hall of Fame, and Kent DeKalvy. Now, DeKalvy was without a doubt one of the most unathletic-looking athletes in pro sports history, but he got it done and then some. Series went the full seven games. Grant Jackson won game seven for the Pirates. The team came back from a 3-1 deficit to win in seven, which is a rarity when you look at Major League World Series history. And it's a great team with an outsized personality, one that got a city and a region and a certain kid you know through some challenging times. So here's to the 79 Pirates. Now, before we all slide into turkey-induced sleep comas, let's start connecting dots in our Thanksgiving edition of the Far Middle. The 79 Pirates and the Pirates for the entire decade of the 70s, they became known as the Lumber Company because they could put a hurting on opposition with their hitting. And today on the geopolitical stage, we see Putin certainly trying to lay the lumber on Europe with his use of energy leverage in the context of the war in Ukraine. But you know, there's a big difference between what's going on in reality with Europe's energy situation and what environmentalists and their allies want to portray to society. So the popular storyline that you hear these days is that Europe and Europeans, they're getting hit hard by Putin and his weaponizing energy. But, you know, the reality, it's quite different than that common storyline because Putin, as we've discussed in prior episodes of the Far Middle, he's nothing more than a predictable symptom or a foreseeable consequence of the root cause of Europe's energy and economic problems, which is misaligned and misguided energy and climate policies. Now, the fact is nothing new to constant listeners of the Far Middle, right? We've discussed this many times in the past. What is new for this week's episode is how this storyline is evolving by those on the left and in the media and within government, bureaucratic, and policy circles about how Putin and what he's doing to Europe's energy security, or lack thereof, is now helping to jumpstart, for lack of a better term, a quicker, a faster rush or dash to renewable energy or green energy. Now, whether it's wind, solar, or electric vehicles, and along with that dash, how the situation with Ukraine and the resulting chaos that it's creating with Europe's energy and economic security, it's putting more and more support of citizens and middle-of-the-road voters and taxpayers, etc., to support green energy and the green movement within Europe itself. So we're being told that there's a silver lining of Putin and war in Ukraine and all the economic chaos that has ensued in Europe, in that they are going to see and experience an energy transition that's quicker and more efficient, and that the moving away from fossil fuels and things like natural gas, that's going to be accelerated, all of which are good things. They, being the left and environmentalists and the media and so on, they see it as a silver lining coming out of that war in the Ukraine. Now, believing that the war in Ukraine has a silver lining, that it's accelerating an energy transition to, you know, zero carbon energy sources or energy transition, whatever you may call it, that is definitely wrong-headed thinking. Don't believe that nonsense. Now, certainly when a bureaucrat or an environmentalist is exposed with the energy chaos that their policies create, and then they're further exposed when a dictator decides to monger war in places like Ukraine or in the situation of a Putin, those individuals whose actions have been exposed, they're going to become desperate. Now, what do bureaucrats and environmentalists and mainstream media and those in academia, what do they typically do when exposed or when feeling pressure? That's right. They often resort to first denial, and then second, doubling down by using the crisis that they caused, ironically or brazenly, as justification to do more of the same type of prescriptions and policies and mandates that got them into the messes to begin with. A perfect and an absolutely perfect current example of this in action with respect to Europe and energy and climate policies in the Ukraine is what the EU Green Deal chief said recently. His name is Mr. Timmermans. Yes, his title is EU Green Deal chief. He said, quote, "Renewables give us the freedom to choose an energy source that is clean, cheap, reliable, and ours," end quote. So let me repeat that. Renewables give us the freedom to choose an energy source that is clean, cheap, reliable, and ours. Now look, I've seen my share of many statements from bureaucrats and environmentalists and the left that ring quite hollow and untrue when you break them down with logic and math and science. But this simple sentence from the EU Green Deal chief is perhaps the most brazen exemplar of deep mistruth that I've seen in a long, long time. So let's break this down word by word, shall we? So the problems start at the very beginning of the sentence. The first word in that sentence that I read from the EU Green Deal chief was renewables. Now, we all know by now that there is no such thing as truly renewable energy. There's no perpetual motion machine, unless you're reading some science fiction book or H.G. Wells or watching The Twilight Zone. And all energy has a carbon footprint when you assess across a life cycle, scopes 1 through 3 basis. So the term renewable energy at the very start of this quagmire of a sentence should alert you that you're about to experience more mistruths, or as our political leader calls it, malarkey, as the sentence unfolds and progresses. Now, the next troubling term in that sentence is the freedom to choose an energy source, that term freedom to choose an energy source. That is a laughable phrase within the sentence because with climate and energy policies that Europe embraces these days, there is an absolute lack of freedom to choose energy sources. Decisions on which energy source and what components of the energy options will make up the portfolio of, say, the grid under today's climate and energy policies and regulations within Europe, and unfortunately increasingly within the United States, those are dictated by government and its cohorts to citizens, to businesses, to value creators, to doers, and ultimately to taxpayers. Same with what mode of transportation you take these days, and so on. Yes, draconian policies that mandate that certain favored energy forms be utilized more than others, and that disfavored forms of energy be penalized relative to others, they're all the rage, and the cause, I might say, of these problems. But then there's the reference later in this magical sentence to clean, cheap, and reliable energy that results from the so-called renewable energy and these policies that create the so-called freedom to choose. Well, the reality, of course, constant listeners, is quite different than what the EU Green Deal chief is warranting. Because as we're learning, Wind and solar and electric vehicles, they are horribly damaging to the environment on both a CO2, scopes 1 through 3 basis, as well as on a surface disruption basis, when you start to consider all the extractive processes and activities that need to occur to come up with the materials and compounds and elements to manufacture those wind turbines, solar panels, and electric vehicle batteries. Wind and solar in particular are also far from cheap. We're learning more and more across different regions and nations and economies, whether it's New England, Texas, California, or Europe, that wind and solar are very costly compared to forms of energy such as natural gas, to the point where the cost of that so-called renewable energy is damaging economies and driving them into recession. But the most outrageous part of this most outrageous of sentences from the EU Green Deal chief is the very last word of the sentence. That word is ours, as in the energy will be ours under a renewable world. Hey, there is nothing about wind, solar, or electric vehicles that is going to be ours. Instead, those forms of energy and those modes of transportation are going to be China's and Russia's. That's because the materials and the compounds and the elements that must be extracted from the earth and that must be processed and that then must be used to manufacture the components of wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicle batteries, they necessarily must be done in those types of nations. Why? Because that's where Mother Earth placed those materials, and also because those are the nations that have strategically positioned themselves by duping the Western world to adopt these types of damaging climate policies and mandates. And then the Chinas and the Russias, they build their economies or retool in some instances their industries to manufacture these components so that they hold our energy security in their hands. The vaunted energy transition is not going to be ours. It's going to be theirs, as in our enemies. And doubling down on these climate policies and using Putin as the reason, it's only making it worse. So maybe it's time to create a new award. This is far middle history in the making, constant listeners. Mark it down. You were there, episode 79, late November 2022. It is the first time that the far middle awarded the Crown of Claptrap. In 2022, the crown goes to the EU Green Deal chief, Mr. Timmermans, coming up with this sentence of renewables give us the freedom to choose an energy source that is clean, cheap, reliable, and ours. Perhaps the most concentrated amalgamation of claptrap ever constructed in the annals of bureaucratic speak. Well done, Mr. Timmermans. Well done. Now, with the first annual claptrap crown placed firmly on the head of a very deserving recipient, we can next turn our attention to a connection which deals with something that's not exactly claptrap, but that would probably fall under the category of irony. Yes, the next topic to discuss is how Ben Bernanke, a prior chair of the Federal Reserve, he won the Nobel Prize in Economics recently, actually shared the prize with two other economists, for the work that he did researching the origins and root causes of financial crises in the 20th century. I want to state at the outset, I've got nothing personally against Federal Reserve chairs. I'm sure that Ben Bernanke and the Janet Yellen and the Jay Powell are all decent human beings and brilliantly smart. Instead, however, I do take exception and I do have a problem with the policies that these chairs have lobbied for, advocated for, pursued and enforced upon not just the U.S. economy, but frankly, the global economy over the past 20 plus years. These policies created negative real interest rates. They bloated asset bubbles in all kinds of asset classes, ranging from real estate to equities to debt to art to commodities. They stoked inflation, they eroded work ethic, and they created a false sense of security that led to fiscal budgets and spending and deficits that may have reached the point of no return when you look at the financial health of many governments, including our own federal government. And worse yet, these destructive policies and negative real interest rates and all their follow-on consequences, they were enforced over the course of not just years, but decades, meaning the damage that they've done will extend for decades further into the future, perhaps even to a level where they become permanent and irreversible. Now, what I find especially distasteful is how the Federal Reserve chairs, they use the convenient crisis of the times, in the case of Ben Bernanke, it was the financial crisis of 08-09, is justification to either initiate or prolong or continue these types of distorted policies over the long haul. So the crisis, they came and they went, but the extreme policies that they justified, they never went away. They just lived on, they continued to distort market behavior and economies more, and they became further cemented into our economies and societies. And this is the primary reason why a lot of people, myself included, consider Ben Bernanke to be one of the key root causes of the 08-09 financial crisis. Bernanke also set precedent for these extreme monetary policies to continue and to live on, where you've got future and subsequent Fed chairs who are able to inherit the policies, defend them, and nurture them and extend them. Yes, no one should ever confuse Ben Bernanke with someone like Paul Volcker. What's ironic with this recent award of a Nobel Prize in economics for his research into the causes and dynamics of financial crises is that Bernanke ended up, despite his research, becoming a root cause of a recent financial crisis. And perhaps, I fear, a major contributor to a financial crisis that's pending and yet to come as our economy learns to cope with the realities of 125% of GDP being held in federal debt and with inflation raging all across the land, all because of years of negative real interest rates and things like quantitative easing stoking the inflation fire. One of the sparks that started that fire was Ben Bernanke. In this discussion of Fed chairs and the wrongs that they do when it comes to monetary policy and the subsequent harm to economies and value creators and taxpayers, it sort of connects us to a side dot to discuss. And that's how the Fed and its leadership over the past 20 years or so, in many ways, has not just been bipartisan, but perhaps more appropriately, it should be described as monopartisan or unipartisan. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's think about it. Since the time of the chair of Bernanke, we have seen a Fed and its leadership that supported the unsustainable economic policies of Presidents Bush II, Obama, Trump, and now Biden. I can't think of a more diverse and politically divided group of presidents. I mean, they span the entire political spectrum, perhaps beyond the ends of each side of the spectrum in some cases. But the one thing that united them, perhaps more than anything else, heck, maybe the only thing that they shared in common, was a more than accommodating Fed when it came to loose monetary policy, free money, negative real interest rates, and support for fiscal deficit spending and run-up of government debt. The Fed, through all those presidents and years, they made the unsustainable and fiscal policy doable by injecting extreme monetary policy into the veins of our economy. Now, the drug's being removed because the symptoms are too severe to ignore any longer, and with it being Thanksgiving and all, this period we are entering into of going cold turkey, it's going to present some epic withdrawal symptoms, so hang on tight. Now, we've been discussing some big topics, right, in this episode. We talked about the fallacies and flaws of the EU Green Deal chief when it came to energy policy statements. We talked about how monetary policy from places like the Fed can make the unsustainable policies in government sustainable, at least for certain periods of time, until the music stops or the drug of free money stops flowing. A big example, of course, being in the energy and climate arena. And when you start to combine these things, you typically will observe bureaucrats within government taking advantage of the very policies that they're creating or enforcing. Of course, that's a huge conflict of interest, and it works against the public interest. But if nobody's paying attention and everybody's distracted with other mindless matters, you know, social media, reality TV, pro sports, etc., then no one needs to account for such behavior within government. So what I want to connect to is a series of stories that I don't know if you saw them. I recently read them in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal back in late October ran a series of front page stories over the course of a week that discussed the numerous ways that influential government bureaucrats and officials across different administrations were taking advantage of different industries that they were responsible for regulating or for overseeing. So they were basically buying or selling of stocks or debt of companies in those industries and then profiting from them. Now, there were numerous examples of officials in government that were buying stocks or bonds of companies that were going to benefit from government decisions and policies and regulations. And then there were also examples where officials in government were selling the stocks and bonds of companies or holdings in certain industries that were going to be penalized or suffer from government decisions or regulations. In the examples discussed in the stories with the case of the EPA and with officials in the DOE, the selling or buying pertain mostly in these news stories to companies in the natural gas or oil industries. So-and-so official was buying a stock or bond of a company that was about to get perhaps good news from the government, or so-and-so official was selling the stock or the bonds of the company that was about to get bad news or more scrutiny from government. Now, these stories in the journal, in the examples that they included, the real examples, by the way, that were documented and discussed, they were all very interesting, but they also got me thinking. and it got me thinking and tying my thoughts back to those energy and climate policies that we discussed at the start of the episode, going back to the monetary policies that help fund or fuel, pun intended, the energy and climate policies, and then going back to the leaders of different government agencies or entities like the Federal Reserve or in the highest levels of government on the executive branch side of things. Because what this series of stories in the journal largely missed was a very important, perhaps the most important item to consider when it comes to these conflicts of interest in government. And that would be the situation where a government official or a bureaucrat is purchasing the stocks or bonds of companies in, say, the wind or solar or electric vehicle industries. In other words, the very types of companies that would benefit directly or indirectly, but in all cases massively, from the corporate graft and from the subsidy the government would bestow upon them under the slew of state and federal and regulatory actions under various climate and energy policies. I think an analysis or an investigation or an expose, whatever you want to call it, would expose the largest category of transgressions in terms of both magnitude and in terms of frequency where this type of conflict of interest exists and is being exploited. Again, that category would be government officials who are profiting from the purchasing of equity or debt of funds in the renewable or hydrogen or EV industries or stocks and bonds of those companies in those sectors. In other words, companies that are directly or indirectly benefiting from the various climate policies and regulations and programs that our government institutes on a regular and near daily basis, all across government, not just portions of it. So since the far middle, we're always interested here in solutions, I've got a fix to all this conflict of interest in government. If the whole of government is going to put its power into pushing and enforcing climate policies, which is what the current administration and our president is saying, then the whole of government should also be precluded and prohibited from profiting through the purchase directly or indirectly of the stock or equity of companies or in funds in the favored industries under these policies. Pretty simple, would be pretty effective. What do you think the odds will be that that simple solution would be implemented? Yeah, my Pirates probably have a better chance of odds of winning next year's World Series. Okay, let's cover up episode 79 of The Far Middle in some foil and put it in the fridge with a leftover turkey. I wrapped the episode with going back to where we started, 1979, Pirates baseball, and one of my top three all-time favorite rock bands, which is the power trio from Canada, Rush. Geddy Lee, the bassist and lead singer for Rush, he's a huge baseball fan. You see him at Blue Jays games in Toronto all the time. He's got this extensive collection of baseball memorabilia, which is awesome. And I've even, believe it or not, I've seen him wearing a 1979 Pirates t-shirt at Rush concerts in the Steel City in Pittsburgh in years past. Well, in 1979, Rush released the single The Trees, and that single is off the album Hemispheres. And The Trees, I think it provides us with some of the best lyrics in the history of rock, at least in my opinion. And the lyrics, of course, were penned by the drummer extraordinaire Neil Peart. He wasn't just their drummer, he was their lyricist, but it was sung by Geddy Lee. And I'm going to leave you with the opening and closing verses of The Trees, because I think those verses are more applicable today than ever. So the opening verse says, "There's unrest in the forest, there's trouble with the trees, for the maples want more sunlight, and the oaks ignore their pleas." Think about that in the context of today. The closing verse of the song ends with, "Now there's no more oak oppression, for they passed a noble law, and the trees are all kept equal by hatchet, axe, and saw." So we lost Neil Peart not long ago, unfortunately, and probably lost Rush is an ongoing power trio group with him. But if I ever get a chance down the road to meet Geddy or to meet the guitarist Alex Lifeson, one of the first questions out of my mouth will be, how did they predict our predicament with government and the left that we're burdened with in late 2022, way back in 1979 when they had those lyrics in The Trees? How did they know? I don't know how they knew, constant listeners, but I do know this. See you with episode 80 in 7 days. In the meantime, go easy on the stuffing.